I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today I am joined by National Book Award finalist Brandon Hobson to discuss his new book, The Removed. Today we talk about the pressures of writing a book after critical acclaim, combating stereotypes against Native Americans, and following one's passions towards a career. The Stacks Book Club pick for March is Everybody Looking by Candace E. Lowe, and we will discuss the book in detail on Wednesday, March 31st with Nick Stone. If you love this show and want more of it, join the Stacks Pack over on Patreon. That's where you can join our monthly book club video chats and connect with other lovers of the Stacks. Here's how it works. You contribute once a month and you earn perks. And you get to know your money is helping make this show possible. If you're interested in joining, head to patreon.com/thestacks. Thank you to our newest members of the Stacks Pack. Andrea Toth, Tasha Samborski, Susan Berry, Anna Berkovich, Rebecca, Emma Weinert, Kimberly Nevels, Heather John Fogarty, Elizabeth Coleman, and Rachel Gonzalez Green. Thank you so much, Stacks Pack. I would be lost without all of you. Okay, now let's talk with author Brandon Hobson. All right, everyone. I am very excited today. I am joined by National Book Award shortlist author. His name is Brandon Hobson, and Brandon's new book just came out this year. It's called The Removed. Brandon, welcome to The Stacks.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
I'm so excited to talk to you. I have a bazillion questions for you, but let's start kind of where we always start, which is in about 30 seconds or so. Can you just tell us a little bit about The Removed?
Sure. So The Removed comes out of the question of violence against natives. And I wanted to parallel the violence that is happening now against natives with the violence that was happening 200 years ago. And so it's really about a family who is dealing with the aftermath 15 years after their son has been shot by a police officer, and how they're coping, trying to learn to heal and to learn to forgive. And at the same time, there is a spirit ancestor who is telling about the trail and how he was killed for refusing to leave when Andrew Jackson sent the soldiers in to remove tribes that came out of Georgia, North Carolina, and ended up in what's now known as Oklahoma, became Indian Territory, which is where I'm from. And that's basically what the book is about.
Yeah. That's good. That was good. You nailed it. So I've heard you talk on other interviews a little bit about the book, and this The Removed has multiple family members, and as you mentioned, also someone sort of from a spirit, an ancestor, who tell the stories in their own voice. And so you're weaving through these different characters. And I heard you say that you wrote each character's story individually and then kind of wove it all together. So I'm curious about a few things, because you're the first author I've ever spoken to who has done it this way. Most people say they kind of write it all at once in different sections. So I'm curious, A, how you decided who you wanted to start with or who you were going to leave for the end. And B, how, if at all, did you keep the stories from bleeding together as you were writing them, knowing what you knew about the first person you wrote about versus the fourth person you wrote about?
So the first part of that question, I believe I started with Maria, the mother's section first. Okay. And I know I've said, I worked on them individually. I think mostly. I know there was a point where I got a long ways into one thread or one character and then began another one. Mm. I don't remember the process. It's been 4 years ago.
Right.
Maybe three years ago. I think I really only spent, just about 2 years writing this. It's not a very long book. So Maria, I think Maria's section was first, because I began with, thinking about the violence and police shootings against Native teenagers, and knew I wanted to write a novel about this. And I'm glad that last, so not to take away from police shootings of other people of color. And I'm, after this last summer with George Floyd and all right. the news media that has, that's attracted national news media, I was thinking about how little that was going on. And this would have been 2018. It was when my last book was out, and I knew I needed, I always have to be working on something.
Okay.
Right. So I immediately jumped into, the idea of just at least start drafting something. Right. And so I'd been reading about that. And so I started Maria's sections, as a mother and her husband, Ernest, who has Alzheimer's, and just really just kind of playing around with them. This question, how are they healing? How are they still coping 15 years after their son had been shot? And so, that's when I started drafting all that, and really, from Maria's perspective. Actually, it started out in third person. I was writing those Maria's sections early on, the mother's in third person. I later switched them to first.
Right. Well, it was how you sort of like kept the characters' own experiences separate as you're writing them from one another.
Yeah. Really, doors opened along the way. Mm. I knew that, that I was writing Maria's section, and then I thought that I want, this needs to be a family. Mm-hmm. So, then Sonia, I believe Sonia's came next. And then Edgar and Chala. Although early on I knew I wanted to incorporate some of the old traditional Cherokee stories into a novel. And I knew I was thinking about how can I thread together these ideas of violence from 200 years ago with paralleling with the violence that's still happening today by the authority, right? Police. And that, that was all beginning. But I think the more I started writing about the family, the more excited I became about, rather than just having a background, sort of a, flashback, going back and jumping back and forth in time, I wanted to do it different. I wanted to do it in a, what I hope is a more unique way or artful way, which is to have these epistolary sections where Chala is speaking to his son. And they were both killed, for refusing to leave the land. And I wanted to have him sort of tell his son traditional Cherokee stories, and also about his manifestation into what becomes a spirit. as he watches the trail, the migration begin, and sees all the suffering and, you know, details and the sickness and disease and cold winter. And that became a very exciting way for me to try to, after I'd written the family story, to go back and thread in Chala.
Right. To kind of like bring it all together and like make,
yeah,
like bring, make it, not make it make sense, but make it have a greater historical resonance.
Yeah, exactly. Because I wanted some history in there, but again, I wanted to do it in a very unique way.
Right.
And in a way, it's not really a traditional way of writing a narrative, is to sort of bring in the spirit voice. But, you know, I look at this as sort of post-colonial novel. Hmm. And I also look at it as the type of fiction that I am interested in. To me, some of the best fiction feels like a work of art.
Yeah.
You know, the writers are artists, and the stuff that I love to read moves me in the way that good art does.
That's so interesting that you say that, because one of the things that I took away from my experience of reading the book was how I always knew what was going on in the story, and I always knew where I was in the story, but there was a lot of sort of mood and suspense that was always sort of changing. And I definitely felt like you were playing with what you wanted your audience to be feeling and experiencing in a way that I think a lot of artists who do visual art, like paintings or film or whatever, that they play with their audience. So I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about that.
You mean the overall vision?
Well, sort of like the vibe. Like, there's parts of this book that felt sort of spooky to me, or felt like maybe like a thriller. Mm-hmm. Like you were cultivating a mood, I felt like. Maybe you weren't. Maybe that's just how I read it in my bathtub. I don't know. But I'm curious, sort of like, aside from the actual story, was there something that you wanted to evoke in your reader?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I want to, in some ways, really move the reader and challenge them in ways that they don't necessarily feel, right? Mm. And I think that, you know, when we're talking about things like violence, abuse, race, and these very serious issues, people need to challenge themselves,
right,
to think about them. And so, yes, this is, you know, this is not a feel good novel. I understand. And it becomes, it's not light. But I want people to really be moved and disturbed, I guess, by some things. And the way that, you know, an influence on me is Murakami. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever read Murakami. He writes about the surreal and the other world, you know, in ways that feel very dreamlike. So I wanted to kind of incorporate that a little bit, because, you know, this is not an essay on a police shooting, racially profiled police shooting. It's 15 years afterwards and how it is still affecting the family. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these things don't go away very easily. Yeah, so I wanted to really challenge the reader.
I think one of the things that I really appreciated about the book is that you seem to respect your audience and trust your audience in a way. I never felt like, I don't know if you ever experienced this, but sometimes I feel like the author is like babysitting me, and they're like explaining every choice and every character and every motivation. And they're like, I'm doing this because blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And so I'm obsessed with author intent and also with author's relationship to the audience. Would you mind speaking a little bit about sort of how you approach writing for your audience and making sure that they are with you without like holding their hand?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that's very important to me, because there's nothing worse that a writer can do than to try to write. I mean, to try to explain, you know, and especially if you're talking about, you know, these are native issues, you know, and I'm talking about tribe. Every tribe is very different. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not going into an explanation about the tribe. I don't even need to feel like I need to go into an explanation about, you know, a history lesson as to what, you know, happened
right
with Andrew Jackson. But there was a student at Institute of American Indian Arts, where I teach part time. And he said, sometimes you have to make fun of your oppressors, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that in a way, I think in this book, Edgar's sections are the absurd mm-hmm. sections, because in a way they feel so surreal, and they end up in this darkening land, which is this sort of mythological place that's mentioned in old Cherokee stories. But, you know, I do some things like have the person inventing this video game that is designed to shoot natives, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. That is on one hand, feels very racist and absurd, but then again, look at what's going on in our right. world right now.
Right. Right.
And, you know, and that his friend, you know, there's some absurd, like, you know, his friend is named Jackson Andrews.
Right.
You know, right. So it's done in an absurd way, but I'm trying to show that the absurdity is not so different than the normal.
Right.
What we're dealing with. Right.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's like a little satirical in those sections. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's actually maybe like a little bit more than just a little. There's some definitely some satire in those sections, in the Darkening Lands, and
yeah, with the especially with the video game manual,
right?
Right, which right. The torturous radioactive mud pit, and in parentheses, you know, TRMP,
right?
And you know, there's some little sort of fun satirical things,
yeah,
right.
You mentioned how, like, you know, this book is not fun, and it's not, you know, you're trying to evoke a certain response or feeling in your reader. Are you, as a writer, able to find joy in writing, or is it really difficult to write a story like this?
I always find joy in writing. And yes, there are some difficult, I mean, it's a very heavy, difficult subject matter, but I really try to tell students that you can write about very, very difficult things, but you should find the pleasure in doing that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and maybe that pleasure comes out of, you know, what I'm writing about here will raise discussions and conversations about things that people aren't comfortable talking about, right? I mean, certainly, you know, people aren't comfortable talking about police shootings, you right. know, and, you know, maybe that's changing. And I think, you know, contributing to the conversation is an important thing for a fiction writer to think about, right? And so I you know, part of the joy, yes, was as a fiction writer, the mythological Darkening Land was fun, you know, and that was because it was so bizarre and you know, it's like writing Fabulous or something sci-fi or something where you just sort of find a lot of fun, and we're reading that kind of stuff sometimes is fun. But you know, the pleasure that I get from writing like Sonia's sections or Maria's sections is more along the lines of really getting inside the head of a character that is nothing like me.
Yeah.
And showing, you know, trying to show what it's like for a mother who has lost her teenage son to a shooting and watching her husband, you know, become more and more forgetful from his Alzheimer's. What is that like? And then how can something like taking in emergency care foster child be life-changing for them? That was starting place. That's where the, you know, the sort of pleasure is discovering those kinds of things.
Yeah.
That you hope really move the story forward and show this, how these characters begin to change.
Yeah. You mentioned sort of one of the impetus of this for writing this book was the police violence against Native children. And I'm curious, mm-hmm. And you also mentioned in this conversation how, you know, that not to take away from other groups that are targeted by police. So I'm curious kind of specifically in what ways you found the police violence against Native youth to be uniquely its own, or specifically like what that looks like.
There was a blame in a lot of the articles that I was reading. There was a blame on the teenager who got shot, that there was mental illness, as if that's, you know, that becomes,
right.
you know, it's a mental illness problem, right? Because people aren't getting enough meds for their mental illness. So, you know, they're going to react violently and they should be shot, right? That's the way the absurdity in that, that maybe it's not a mental illness problem. Maybe it's a police problem.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a racial problem, right? Yeah. So, I mean, that to me, you know, it is really just, you know, jaw-dropping that I was reading these articles and they were blaming this, you know, on mental illness. Is there a mental illness problem in the United States? Of course there is. A lot of people, right? I mean, but I, you know, it just felt really, really unfair to those kids who have died to say that really the reason they got shot was because they weren't getting, or they were suffering from a mental illness.
Right.
That seems very, very unfair to me.
Yeah. I mean, it's totally unfair, and it's, you know, a way to avoid having to take any responsibility for any actions, which is something that we see so commonly with white power, or white people in power. I'm also curious, I guess, because this book, you said you started in 2018, we're now in 2021. In the summer of 2020, we had this sort of racial reckoning where white Americans started to deal with their understanding of race, I guess, allegedly in a different way, which we can talk about, I mean, on another podcast. But I'm curious, as someone, you know, because I think not only was it about white people's relationship to blackness and anti-blackness and other people of color's experiences, but I do think there was also sort of a call to reckon with the ways that Native people have been abused also. And I think that that was brought into the conversations in a lot of circles that I have been a part of. So I'm kind of curious in what ways this book was there any, like, I want to change something? Was there any, like, feeling of, I wish that this could be here, or a connection to the, you know, any sort of connection or change that you felt like because of what happened over the summer?
Well, really changing the stereotype, right? Since the summer, it feels like, you know, people are having conversations now, which is great. And, you know, it feels more hopeful, I think, you know, than it used to. But I was thinking more about, I mean, in terms of this book, trying to get away from the stereotype of how natives are labeled as savage, right? Is an old term that's used a lot. And Hollywood seems to me to be, and I hope this is changing, but they seem to be very interested in wild people, portraying them as, you know, these sort of outsiders, and, you know, having a very stereotype image, which is, I think, you know, ridiculous. I hope that it's changing.
Sure.
Tommy Orange had this fantastic novel, talking about the urban native, of course, that I hope that stereotype will slowly change, go away, that, you know, that people can start to see natives as normal, regular people. And also, you know, natives are often defined by how much blood count, blood quantum, and how they look a lot, you know. And that comes out of, you know, the whole thing, this colonization culture comes out of, you know, like my struggle of sort of wondering, am I native enough to write about this? Or am I native enough, you know?
Right. And who has the answer to that? Who decides that? Is that a you thing? Like, do you decide when you're native enough for yourself, or are you waiting for someone to vote? Like,
it's those are, you know, and I'm certainly not the only person to,
of course not,
to face that, you know, and because I think it certainly probably happens, you know, among other people of color, right?
Sure, certainly.
Yeah. And, but it's, you know, it's so problematic. And that comes out of that colonization of here's the way it is and here's what you can't do.
But also, so, I think, don't you think it also comes, in addition to that, it also comes from that not wanting to take response, like white people not wanting to take responsibility for their actions. And so they want to be able to project some sort of culpability on the victim. So if you're not native enough to tell this story, therefore the story does not get to be told, because you don't get to tell it, because I, person who has you know, victimized your people have now decided that you actually aren't even one of those people. So how dare you tell this story about how I'm a bad guy, you know?
Yes, absolutely. Oh man, you said that so beautifully.
I think about this stuff all the time.
Yeah. Yes, write that down.
Okay. I've got it recorded. I can transcribe.
Yeah. No, that is absolutely spot on. Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's take a quick break, and then I want to talk more with you about your process. It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated, and AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number smart beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first 3 orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
So the first thing I want to know sort of about the process is the title. When did you come to the title of this book, and how did you know it was the one?
I was struggling with the title. I knew it wanted to be, you know, writing about the removal. Mm. And with Chala's section about the removal, you know, from the land, and how the family seems removed from each other and, you know, sort of removed from their own thoughts of their, you know, their own feelings of healing and forgiveness. But I wasn't sure what the title was exactly. Then my friend, Brad McClelland, who is he's a writer also, he writes a middle grade series, he and I were having coffee at a coffee shop, you know, I was telling him about the book and everything, and he's the one that recommended, he said, how about The Removed? You know, and I thought, yeah, that's great. That's, you know, so that's really, he's the one I credit him in the book, you know, for really giving me that. But I knew that it, I wanted it removal or something, you know, because that was so apparent, so evident with, within all the characters.
Yeah. And where do you write physically? Are you in your home? I mean, obviously with the pandemic, things are maybe slightly different, but I guess pre-pandemic or during pandemic, where are you writing? What's your setup like? Do you have snacks and beverages? Do you have any rituals like lighting a candle? Can you listen to music? Sort of like set the scene for how you like to write.
I write in, yeah, I have an office at home, which is a room with my computer and my books and my guitar. And I don't know that there are any rituals because I can also go to a coffee shop and, and I sort of like, I, you know, as a change of pace, I sort of like the, I think it's, I can still get into that zone, right? And with the stimulation from people and, you know, or music playing, but mostly with the pandemic, I have, you know, sort of just seclude myself. And write anytime, mostly it's late at night when everybody, when the house is quiet and everybody's asleep, I will usually try to write for, you know, a good 3 hours, 4 hours. And if I can, sometimes throughout the day, if I'm not teaching or grading or working with students, if I have, you know, a couple of hours, I'll try to knock out a page or do some editing or something. A big part of it for me is just pulling up the manuscript on the computer and just working on it, getting into the chair, pulling it up. It's kind of like going to the gym for me.
Okay.
It's, it's once I can get to the gym, I will have a good workout. But 90% of the difficulty is me changing clothes and getting in the car and driving to the gym.
Right.
That's more difficult. Once I get there, it's like, okay, yeah, I can do this. But so
you skimmed my favorite part of the question, which is snacks or beverages. Can you have them? Yeah. Do you, are you accompanied by anything to eat or drink?
I usually don't eat when I'm working, but I do keep water or coffee often.
And how do you take your coffee?
You know, I like iced coffee, to be honest.
Oh, okay.
I put half and half and sweetener in it.
Yes.
I like it sweet. I don't, I've never understood people that just drink it, you know, like straight black without any kind of creamer or sweetener. I just love to sweeten it, right?
Yeah. I don't drink coffee because I only like to consume things that give me great pleasure. And I think coffee tastes disgusting, but I do drink tea, and I drink my tea very milky and very sweet because I, again, only like to consume things that are pleasurable. Why would I drink this if I didn't taste good?
Right.
So my husband is team all black coffee. Like, he once got mad at me because I didn't know at Starbucks, if you order an iced coffee, it comes with sweetener in it. And he was like, what is this? It's like, well, sorry. Like, oh, I don't get it. But some people just like to be miserable, I guess. I don't know.
I can't drink it straight black. I have to have it. It's kind of like tea. I have to sweeten tea.
Yeah.
You know, if I drink iced tea, I have to put, you know, if not sugar, sweetener in it or something, which I know is not good for you. But
well, nothing's good for you anymore. You know,
just, that's right.
We have to do what feels nice these days. Okay, so what other stuff sort of, if you remember, I know that this was a while ago that you wrote the book, so some people can't always remember, but do you remember what sort of stuff you were reading or watching or listening to while you were writing this book that maybe kind of influenced you in any way?
Well, I was thinking about Murakami.
Okay.
You know, some of his work. Who was I also thinking? I was thinking about Jasmine Ward's Sing Unburied Sing.
Sure.
Yeah, which is, you know, a beautiful novel. And told from different voices, right?
Yeah.
And still a relatively, it's not a huge book, you know.
No. It's very short.
Yeah, it's under 300 pages. And but I like the way, well, she's brilliant, first of all.
Yeah.
But the way that she, you know, threads the voices and those stories in Sing Unburied Sing is just amazing. So I know that You know, I was thinking about that book.
Yeah. When I shared my sort of little mini review online of the book, someone commented, this sounds a little bit like Sing Unburied Sing. And my first reaction was like, no, it's not. And then I was like, actually, these books are definitely in conversation with one another because there's the history and then there's this one family and it's the multiple perspectives and there's sort of the surreal, like they are sort of like book cousins, maybe.
Well, that's an honor that I can be compared to her at all. You know, I think she's just an amazing, brilliant writer but I think it's probably, you know, an influence on this book and on me.
Yeah. One of the other things in this book is that Maria, the mother character, is a recently retired social worker. And I'm pretty sure I've heard that you were a social worker at one point. When did you decide to make the transition from doing social work into becoming a writer?
Well, I was a social worker for 7 years. It was from the time I was 29 to 36. And but I was writing before then. You know, since I got to college, I really fell in love with it and started writing fiction. But I've always been writing. It's just that those 7 years, you know, my mom was a social worker and is retired now. And it was kind of a job that I fell into because at the time I really needed a decent job that had benefits and you know, that it's, I think social workers are just, it's are like teachers and that they're underpaid and for right. the amazing work that they do and the things that they see. And I left because I wanted to pursue my PhD and I really wanted to follow my passion, which was to write, to really focus on writing and also teaching. And I knew I had to get a PhD. I didn't apply for an MFA. I just went on for the PhD. I already had an MA. Mm. And
you're like, I need to get that big degree.
Well, it's just, I mean, it was just more convenient because I was right there in Oklahoma.
Sure.
And
okay.
Yeah. You know, at the time our oldest son was about to be born and I didn't want to do a big move. And so it was, just really following much more of my passion. And I still have this soft place in me, you know, to help people and to help, especially teenagers. Mm. You know, I grew up in a town that was, in parts, it was, you know, a little bit rough. And, you know, I had a lot of friends and, you know, who struggled and various things in their home. And, you know, it's just always been a part of my life and my mom's life. And so, but I just wanted to go on and follow my passion, really.
Was there anyone who inspired you to be a writer, or how did you know you wanted to write?
I took an introduction to literature class. And at the same time, I was also deciding what I wanted to major in. And I knew, I was like, well, I like to read, you know, I wasn't really sure, but that introduction to literature class, when I had some contemporary literature in there, really got me interested. So I enrolled in an introduction to creative writing. And I just really, really loved it. I just thought, wow, this is so much fun. I love this. And then when I did my master's, I took a class with Stuart O'Nan, who is a novelist. And he was at the time, he doesn't teach anymore, but at the time he was a visiting professor. And I took a couple of writing classes with him. And once I took those with him, it really opened up all this amazing, like he was the one that sort of opened up this amazing world of book writers I had not heard of.
Yeah. Since you have a PhD, which is very fancy, this question is extra important. So think carefully. What is the word you can never spell correctly on the first try?
Ooh. Wow. You may have to pause. Let me think for just a second because I'm... I know that there's one that I come across a lot. Resilience, maybe?
I believe it. That's a hard one.
Because I don't know if it's ANC or ENC. It's ENC, isn't it? Resilience, ENCE.
You're truly asking the most wrong person. I was going to say wrongest, but that's also not a word. So I can't spell any word correctly on the first try. So resilience, who knows? It could be I or E, maybe A. I don't know. It's a great question.
Yeah. I know. I come across those words that, you know, I'm that end in ANC or ENCE that I tend to, you know, wow, I know I'm going to think of one because I know there's one really word that makes me feel very dumb I've come across. I just can't think of it right now.
That's okay. I feel like resilience is very good. I'm curious, you know, you've written a bunch of books and your book before this one, Where the Dead Sit Talking, was shortlisted for the National Book Award. And how do you follow up something like that? Like, how do you navigate that yourself?
Yeah, that was that book didn't get a lot of attention until it was shortlisted for the National Book Award. It was not reviewed in very many places. It was published by an independent publisher, you know, Soho Press. Good distribution through Penguin Random House, but was not reviewed, didn't get much attention at all until, you know, I was just absolutely floored to be longlisted. And then when it became a finalist, I just couldn't believe it. But I part of it is, you know, I have other books earlier that are small press that I'm just sort of not used to any kind of pressure, I guess. It's like, well, I'm just going to do this. If people pay attention and read it, they do. I think what becomes paralyzing for a lot of writers, and maybe a lot of writers who have big debut books that get, you know, really big New York Times reviews, maybe wins big awards, as a, you know, publishing is always big on debuts, it seems like. And really, I wonder if that's not paralyzing to a writer to think, now my second book is going to immediately be the follow-up's going to not be nearly as good, right? That seems to me like a lot of pressure.
Right,
the more we build up a debut novelist. But I don't know. I can't speak to that because I was not, my first two books, you know, are just, you know, not really even in print and not many people have read them. So, you know, when this one, when Where the Dead Sit Talking, you know, got some attention, I was very excited. And so I don't think that it really put any pressure on this for me because, you know, it's not like I ever got much money or anything. So, I mean, I'm just trying to do what I find pleasurable, right?
Yeah. That's sort of nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think for a lot of people, the success or the acknowledgement or the critical acclaim or whatever you want to call it can be paralyzing, whether it's their first book or their fifth book or whatever. But it's nice to know that you feel like, you know, I'm just going to write my book. See what happens.
You know, at some point it's like, I mean, the older I get and start thinking, I just feel very lucky just to be able to do it. I mean, to be alive and to be healthy, to watch my kids grow, you know, I feel very blessed in that way that, yeah, I want people to read it. But I mean, there are a lot more important things that should be placed, you know, in my priorities.
Yeah.
You know, thinking about health and, you know, my kids and family and taking care of them. And as long as I can continue to do this, I love it. Even if, you know, everything I wrote from this point on, nobody ever wanted to read, I would still be writing because I think a big part of it is, you know, writing for myself. And I think, you know, maybe where writers get sort of blocked is when they worry too much about thinking about the readership. The thing about, you know, this book was I guess what bothers me a little bit. I apologize if I'm rambling, but
don't worry.
You know, it was a January Book of the Month club and they labeled it, I think, contemporary fiction, which it seemed weird because the book feels very much like literary fiction to me. I feel like a very, you know, if we're going to categorize things, it's more literary fiction.
I don't even know the difference between those two categories.
I just think that thinking about readers when they think about contemporary, they think more about, you know, writers maybe like Kristen Hannah.
Okay, I see.
And it's a little bit more, I don't know, I can't say because I haven't read that book, right? But I mean, my stuff is going to be a little bit weirder and going to be a little bit more, you know, focused on language than plot, for example. Right. I want to focus on looking at, thinking about language and why a character says something rather than following that, you know, sort of traditional plot. So I think a lot of people may have, from Book of the Month or something, may have thought, well, this book is not what they thought it was, or I don't know. I mean, I can worry about that stuff, but at the same time, screw it. I mean, right. This is the book. You know, that kind of thought becomes problematic. And, you know, you just can't, like what Toni Morrison said, right? Write the book that you most want to read.
Right.
So that's what I try to do, as odd as they come out or whatever.
But like odd in a good, like such a good way. I feel like,
well, thank you.
I don't know. I don't know if I would use the word odd. I think your book is so good. So I don't want you to diminish it to my audience, because I don't want my audience to think that it's odd and have a negative connotation. It's very good. You need to talk nicer about your books.
I know. Yeah. I'm all about self.
Oh my gosh, I feel you. I'm the most self-deprecating person, but I don't like when authors talk bad about their books that I liked, because then it makes me feel like I am weird, and I don't like to feel weird. Just kidding.
Thank you for that. It's I just like to do different stuff, right?
Yeah.
But I love it. You know, I love doing what I want to do.
Well, so. I think that's what makes your book so good and interesting, is that they're very clearly something, you know, like there is clearly a point of view and an artistry to the work. And it's not, you know, trying to be anything else. It's unique and authentically itself, whatever the thing is, it is, which I think, you know, is unfortunately rare in literature, because I think so many people are worried about fitting in a specific box or whatever that is, or feeling like they need to be marketed one way or the other. And I feel like what I appreciated about The Removed was that I was struggling to figure out what it was, and I never once had a problem with that. Like, it was part of the reading experience to be like, where am I now? What's happening now? Like, what does that feel like? What does that mean for me or to me? And how is that changing? And that's a really thrilling experience for a reader, especially when the book, it doesn't have a ton of plot, you know? Like, I mean, there's a lot of stuff does happen, but to be able to evoke that in a reader without having a lot of like things happening is really very cool. At least that was my experience of it.
Well, thank you. I mean, part of the fragmented language and some of the, you know, the things I was doing with, you know, jumping around points of, you know, different voices and so forth, you know, is intentional, and a focus on that, you know, on how disjointed things feel out there in the world when people are shooting. I mean, you know, not everything is perfectly aligned.
Right.
And, you know, so
yeah. Okay. So for people like me who really enjoyed your book, and we will refrain from mentioning Sing Unburied Sing again, but for people who love your book, what are other books that you recommend to them that maybe are in conversation? Obviously, they don't have to be the same, but books that you feel like kind of speak to what you've done with The Removed.
My friend Kelly Jo Ford's Crooked Hallelujah.
Okay.
Is a native. She's a Cherokee Nation citizen, as I am enrolled. And but it's more of, you know, book of it's more of stories, a novel and stories about mother daughter relationships, but I think that they still speak to the experience of natives and displacement, those same kind of themes that I'm interested in.
That's awesome. I have that book. I have not read it yet, so I need to pick it up. And I guess I have just one more question for you, which is, if you could have one person, dead or alive, read The Removed, who would you want it to be?
I wish Michelle Obama or President Obama, Barack Obama would read it. I would, yeah, the one of those two. Yeah, one of the Obamas.
That would be my answer every single time to this question. Anyone who answers anything that's not an Obama, I'm like, what do you mean? Oh my gosh. A dream.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, Brandon, thank you so much for your time today. For everyone at home, the book again is called The Removed. It's by Brandon Hobson. Brandon, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tracy. It was an honor to speak with you today.
Thank you. And everyone else, we will see you in the stacks. Thank you to Brandon for being my guest today, and thank you to Caitlin Mulroney-Liskey and Rachel Sargent for making this interview possible. Remember, the Saks Book Club pick for March is Everybody Looking by Candace Elo. We will be joined by Nick Stone for that discussion on Wednesday, March 31st. Please make sure you're subscribed to the Stacks wherever you get your podcasts, and if you're listening to us through Apple Podcasts, be sure to leave a rating and a review. For more from the Stacks, follow us on social media at the Stacks Pod on Instagram and at the Stacks Pod _ on Twitter, and check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. Sebastian Alcala is our sound editor and producer. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tagirajis. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.